From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Forbidden City, a sacred land, Shangri-La. For centuries, Tibet has held a special place in the West's collective imagination. It's been the subject of such recent films as Kundun and 7 Years in Tibet, and the Dalai Lama has been on the bestseller list. We'll talk with China expert Orville Schell about his new book, Virtual Tibet, a look at our collectively imagined Western version of Tibet. And we meet Vitan Saroy, publisher of Kosovo's leading independent Albanian newspaper. Saroy has just received an award from the National Endowment for Democracy. During NATO's bombing of Kosovo, Saroy was in hiding there, and the newspaper was published in exile. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Microsoft Corporation today asked a federal judge to set aside the government's plan to split it in two. The software giant said the punishment doesn't fit the crime. A judge found Microsoft in violation of antitrust laws. Microsoft is offering its own remedies. For one thing, it says it'll stop displaying its Windows operating system on the system, a desktop icon that steers users to its web browser. It's also willing to let computer makers feature any software on the desktop, including software from Microsoft's rivals. Officials have ordered the evacuation of the entire town of Los Alamos, New Mexico, after high winds drove a forest fire closer to inhabited areas. Marcos Martinez of member station KUNM reports.
Police and sheriffs are going door to door, urging people to get out as quickly as possible. Earlier today, the week-old fire pushed closer to town, and fire officials said high winds made it too dangerous to fight the fire. There are 11,000 residents in Los Alamos, which is home to the Los Alamos National Laboratories. The labs have been closed all week because of the fire. Los Alamos is shrouded in smoke as bumper-to-bumper traffic makes its way out of town. No injuries or property damage have been reported. New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson says the town of Los Alamos is in imminent danger. The fire started as a controlled burn at Bandelier National Monument and has been fanned by high winds. For NPR News, I'm Marcos Martinez.
Campaigning in a state with a large proportion of elderly residents, GOP presidential candidate George W. Bush outlined his ideas on how to make long-term health care more available and affordable. Michelle O'Neill of member station WVIK reports from Davenport, Iowa.
Texas Governor George Bush spoke to a group of about 70 senior citizens and local Republicans this morning at an assisted living center. Bush says long-term care insurance is too expensive and causes too many seniors to lose their life savings. And if elected president, Bush says he would change the nation's income tax deductibility rules.
To allow all taxpayers, even those who do not itemize, to be able to deduct the cost of long-term care insurance. Make the policy more affordable.
Many home caregivers are unpaid family members, and Bush would also establish a $2,700 exemption for each elderly or disabled person they take care of. For NPR News, I'm Michelle O'Neill in Davenport, Iowa.
The government says saline-filled breast implants can stay on the market. The Food and Drug Administration has approved implants made by two California companies. The decision comes despite warnings from FDA advisors that the implants break open at alarmingly high rates. On Wall Street, stock prices were lower. The Dow was off 169 points to close at 10,367, and the Nasdaq was down 200. You're listening to NPR News. It was another rocky day for the Nasdaq. It lost 200 points, that's 5%, to close at 3,385, the lowest close in almost a month. NPR's Snigna Prakash reports.
Nasdaq investors can't win for trying these days. Times are so good that Cisco Systems says it can't get enough parts to satisfy demand. The company's chief executive warns profits could be hurt in coming months, and Cisco, a major component of the Nasdaq index, fell by almost 7%. The other factor in the Nasdaq's fall is that investors expect companies will soon face harder times as the Federal Reserve continues its efforts to slow down the economy by raising short-term interest rates. The Fed has been only modestly successful so far, so investors fear it may raise rates by as much as half a percentage point next week instead of just a quarter. The Nasdaq index's biggest loser was Intel, which announced a recall that will create production bottlenecks and lower profits. The Nasdaq has fallen every day so far this week. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
United Nations officials today said UN peacekeepers in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, are preparing for a pitched battle with rebels of the Revolutionary United Front. The rebels are still holding about 500 UN troops. Officials say the UN mission has been consolidating its positions and particularly concentrating troops around entry points to Freetown. Half of South Africa's workforce went on strike for 24 hours today, protesting against soaring unemployment. The South African Chamber of Business said the manufacturing sector was hardest hit. 60% of the workers stayed away. Unions estimate 4 million workers stayed home. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tibet has captured the imagination of Westerners for centuries. It's been seen as the unreachable city shrouded in mystery on the rooftop of the world, a sacred place where monks can transcend the trappings of the physical world and oracles can foresee the future. Since the 50s, much of Tibetan culture has been destroyed by the Chinese occupation. My guest Orville Schell has written a new book called Virtual Tibet, about the place of Tibet in the collective Western imagination and the fantasy versions that have been created in our pop culture. Schell is a China scholar. He's also the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. I asked him what the manifestations of Tibet were in American pop culture when he started his book.
When I started the book, Hollywood was just beginning to gear up to do a number of films on Tibet. There was 7 years in Tibet, the story of Heinrich Harrer's 7 years in Lhasa during the war. Martin Scorsese was gearing up to do the story of the Dalai Lama's early life in Kundun. There were many documentaries being made. Even Steven Seagal was planning an action pic. And I sort of picked up on this and I thought, oh, this is interesting. It looks like we're going to go through another sort of incarnation of the West's fascination with this mysterious and interesting place. And I thought, well, I'm interested in Tibet too, but maybe what I should try to cover is not Tibet itself, but this our version of Tibet, what I like to call virtual Tibet, and to try to look at it through these movies and through other aspects of its manifestation, if you will, in popular culture and politics.
Why? To see what we want from a place like Tibet? What did you want to do by looking at this virtual Tibet?
I was very fascinated in Tibet myself, and I had fallen under its spell as a young boy when I first read Heinrich Harrer's 7 Years in Tibet, which came out in the early 50s, and this wonderful story of adventure about this Austrian mountain climber who'd been arrested by the Brits during the war, escaped from prison camp in India, climbed over the Himalayas, and spent 2 years making his way through tremendously arduous circumstances to Lhasa, where he became the tutor of the Dalai Lama. And this created for me, too, a sort of a childhood vision of this marvelously detached other place that was tucked behind the Himalayas. So I had been inoculated in an early age, like many people, with the idea of Tibet. So, and of course, I've had a longtime interest in China, and I think it's fair to say that what China has done to Tibet, its occupation, is one of the great tragedies of this century. So there was sort of a double payoff for me. There was one, the fantasy of this place, and two, then there was the tragedy of Tibet and this incredibly intractable issue, which seems to brook all efforts to resolve it, that between China and Tibet, and indeed Tibet's place in the whole panoply of problems that China runs into in trying to become a respectable power integrated into the world community.
Why don't you place us briefly, when did China invade Tibet?
Well, in 1949, when the communists took over the mainland, Mao Zedong had Deng Xiaoping, who was in a military command adjacent to Tibet, start to occupy the eastern regions and ultimately march all the way to Lhasa. And it must be said that after that, almost every monastery in Tibet was destroyed. But indeed, the same thing happened in China. There was this very violent, militant reaction against traditional culture, and it extended to Tibet, which, of course, was the paradigm of traditional culture. And then in 1959, after an interregnum where there was a certain amount of cooperation between China and the government of the Dalai Lama, things heated up again. There was a rebellion, and the Dalai Lama fled to India, where he has lived in exile in Dharamsala ever since.
Tibet has become an important place for Hollywood, not just because of movies that Hollywood has made about Tibet, but also because a lot of Hollywood stars have become very interested in Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, particularly, of course, Richard Gere, who's been a Buddhist for about 25 years. And I think the Dalai Lama has even been to Hollywood functions. Why do you think that the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism is making such an impact on celebrities now?
Well, I think each gets something out of it. You know, the celebrities are really questing for some sort of spiritual meaning. In a certain sense, I mean, celebrities are in the very center of this vortex of, you know, of commerce and money and business and deal making. And I think many of their lives lack a certain sort of spiritual quotient. And the Dalai Lama, on the other hand, I mean, he's looking for salvation for his people. And one can hardly fault him for, you know, taking every opportunity to write a little larger the story of what's happened to Tibet and Tibetans. And so he finds it compelling to go to Hollywood to have these rich and powerful people who have access to the media speak on his behalf and buddy up with him. But there is a kind of a paradox involved because historically speaking, one of the reasons we've always loved the Dalai Lama and been so fascinated with him, this sort of God-king notion, is that he has been aloof. He has been unapproachable. He has been tucked away in Lhasa, and we couldn't get access to him. And if there's anything that drives people to frantic levels of enthrallment in Hollywood, it's not being able to get access to someone. Well, so here he is in Hollywood going to fundraisers, which, as I say, one can hardly fault him for doing. But at the same time, that sort of ineffable spiritual aloof quality that has made him so interesting to people is in some sense diminished. So he's kind of walking a really tricky tightrope between too much availability and no availability, which is certainly bad for his cause because his only avenue of appeal, he has no country, he has no ambassadors, he isn't in the UN. So the only thing he can do is to be one man making pleas to get exposure through the media.
The West has idealized Tibet as a Shangri-La, as this, utopian spiritual society. On the opposite side, we have China, which has not only, invaded Tibet and destroyed most of the temples there and imprisoned many of the Buddhists there, but China has also described Tibet as a feudal system where the Dalai Lama ruled over exploited serfs. Is there any truth at all to the Chinese point of view of Tibet having been a feudal system?
Yes. I mean, I think one would have to say that the old system, even though people adored the Lord Buddha and were held in a kind of a society was stable. There are not a lot of examples of rebellion, and it did function in a way. But yes, the estates that were the fundamental kind of building block of Tibetan society were controlled both by the monasteries and by the aristocrats, and ordinary Tibetans were in a serf-like status working on these estates. And that's why when China looked up there, and having been through the process of land reform itself, of liberating peasants and taking land from the landlords and giving it to the peasants, they thought, well, here's another good opportunity for us to bring Marxist, Leninist, Maoist liberation theology to an even more benighted place. And I mean, this is part of the Western vision has a hard time incorporating the old society, the brutal aspects of the old society in its new sort of veneration of what Tibet was. And we look back very nostalgically at the way it was and like to overlook the fact that it did have some tremendously unequal, exploitative, and indeed unjust aspects to it.
My guest is Orville Schell, and he's written extensively about China. His new book is called Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. The geography of Tibet, as you point out, contributed to making Tibet so mysterious and isolated. Because it's surrounded by mountains, it's very hard to get to. At the same time, Tibet wanted to remain isolated. Why did it want to remain isolated for so long?
Well, it was a combination of Tibet not really knowing what was in the outside world and feeling quite sufficient unto itself. Tibetans were pretty content just to stay home, but it so happened that Tibet itself became the object of the exploratory curiosity of the West. And this is a very sort of different cultural aspect that is a hallmark of Tibetan society and culture, and I think a part that makes us rather intrigued, because we are so inquisitive, we are so Promethean, we are so eager to conquer, to explore, to reach out. And the West had colonies, the West had explorers, the West had wars, and Tibet was just sitting there quietly alone at home, minding its own business. And it was, it did intrigue us. It was the antithesis of everything that we felt. And, you know, particularly in the 30s, as Europe and the West headed towards apocalypse and war, Frank Capra's movie Lost Horizon came out and enshrined forever the notion of Shangri-La in popular culture, one of the most powerful utopian mythologies, I think, that we've had during this century. And it basically bespoke of a place where people didn't get old, they didn't get sick, where everything was peaceful and civilized. And it was an intoxicating dream for the West, heading into the nightmare of World War II.
In 1904, there was a British mission that was sent to Tibet to try to prevent Tibet from opening relations with Russia. And the force was sent off by the British Viceroy in India. It was led by Colonel Francis Younghusband, who set off from India to Lhasa with, you say, about 1,000 British and Indian troops. They had guns. The Tibetans didn't. What were the results of this in Tibet?
Well, the Younghusband expedition was a very sorry episode in British imperial history. The British were fearful that Tibet, Lhasa, would unite with the Tsarist government in Russia. And so they sent this expedition. They battled their way through Tibet, killing thousands of Tibetans, and they reached Lhasa and forced the Tibetans to sign an accord. And what was really strange about this trip was that as the soldiers are on their way up, they're writing all of these diaries about Tibet and the enormous sense of expectation at last being the first people in 100 years to reach Lhasa is overpowering. They're so excited at the prospect of getting to the heart of this mysterium. And in fact, when they get there, they see the Potala, the winter palace of the Dalai Lama on Red Hill, and they were extraordinarily excited. But when they get into Lhasa itself, they find it rather grubby and run down and a lot of mangy dogs running in the street. And they find that the Tibetan theocracy is not quite as exalted in terms of spiritual calories as they'd imagined, that it's, quite bureaucratic and sometimes quite oppressive. And they leave off quite dispirited. But the fact was that they did leave lots of accounts, and it didn't dim the West's passion for Tibet and the West's eagerness to imbue it with mythic kinds of proportions. And then, of course, the mountain climbers came into the scene. And
the mountain climbers came looking for adventure?
Well, Europe used to loathe mountains. But around the 18th, 19th century, suddenly as landscape painting became interesting to people and naturalism began to become more intriguing, you began to get a new appreciation of mountains, not just as formidable and ugly and cold, but as beautiful and pure and almost religious in significance. But alas, the British had no mountains. Their mountains were, such as they were north of India in the Himalayas. So they began to imbue the Himalayas with a whole mysticism of its own. And mountain climbers then began to seek to conquer some of these Himalayan peaks. And you get lots of very, very purple, some of it very good writing, actually, about the majesty of the Himalayas and the beauty of the mountains, their purity. And this, too, imbued Tibet with a more kind of sacred quality than ever before. So this is a new element that got added to some of the old ideas of Tibet as being just a spiritually dense and important place. Suddenly it became a natural landscape that was very interesting to Europeans, and that added a whole new dimension, which continues on today with our fascination with Mount Everest and our fascination with heights as being, you know, close to heaven, close to God.
My guest is Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet. Now, the book that got you interested in Tibet was 7 Years in Tibet by Heinrich Harrer, the book that was made into a film a few years ago starring Brad Pitt. You actually went to the set of the Brad Pitt movie. What was it about the book that you loved?
Well, I think what I liked about the book was that it's a great adventure story for a young boy. Heinrich Harrer, his 2 years eluding bandits and eluding the militia of the Tibetan government, and then reaching this forbidden city at last and being taken in by this mysterious god king and becoming his friend. He was only a teenager then, the Dalai Lama, and Auschneider and Harrer, who Auschneider was Harrer's partner, were just young men. So that did kind of, I think, plant the seed of a place that had great magic and mystery for me. And so when I heard that 7 Years in Tibet was being made, I thought, well, let's have a look. And indeed, I was able to go down to Argentina, where they rebuilt Lhasa in the Andes. They couldn't get to Tibet, and the Indian government was so frightened of China's reaction, because this subject of Tibet is so sensitive, that they wouldn't let them shoot in Ladakh, where there are many Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. So there, down in the Andes, Lhasa sprang forth full-blown, like, you know, Athena out of the head of Zeus, and they flew in 150 Tibetans, including many elderly monks from around the world. And when they arrived on the set of the Jokhang, the most sacred spiritual it's a monastery, sort of a cathedral. It's hard to describe exactly what it is in Western terms. But when they arrived at that set, they felt as if they had arrived back home. And many of them hadn't been to Tibet since 1959 when they fled. And they literally fell down, prostrated themselves before this set, some weeping and others feeling tremendously emotional at this kind of very curious homecoming. And then ultimately they had a ceremony to bless the set.
You make a lovely comparison in the book to Brad Pitt and Tibet, in the sense of how Brad Pitt has been kind of romanticized and all the fantasies that his fans project onto him being so similar to how people have fantasized so much about Tibet. I mean, one's just like a person, an actor, and the other is Tibet. But still,
well,
like,
you know,
that comparison.
When I was down in Argentina, it sounds a little corny to say, but there really was a feeling that if that set, that virtual set of Lhasa, had a god king, it was Brad Pitt. I mean, he was not always around. He was sort of aloof. He was hidden. I was told I couldn't see him. I couldn't speak to him. The PR people said that if, in fact, I ran into him on the set, I was in no circumstances to make a lunge at him and try to make contact. So for me, there did build up a kind of a counter mythology of this Hollywood God King on his virtual Tibetan set. And I did see him down there, but I didn't approach him, and ultimately was able to interview him. And I mean, I felt a little bit like Sir Francis Young husband entering Lhasa. I mean, it was a bit of a disappointment to finally meet this incarnation of the real Brad Pitt, and to ask his views on Tibet and his film, and you know, they weren't that interesting. And so there was a kind of a mythology there that was punctured, and it kind of highlighted for me the ways in which we do build up mythologies around people and places that are not accessible, and we can make of them what we will, and we do.
One thing I really admired about Brad Pitt when you interviewed him is that although his answers weren't necessarily very interesting or revealing, he did make a point of saying, I'm not a historian, I'm not a politician, you know, there's a limit to what I know or can tell you about Tibet, there's a limit to my opinions on Tibet. I was glad at least that he wasn't pretending to know a lot more than he did and pretending to have wisdom that he didn't have.
Yeah, he was a nice person, and he said, you know, listen, I'm just a guy who puts on makeup. I mean, he wasn't trying to be very oracular. And anyway, the film people had said it wouldn't do to say too much because China at that point had been making big trouble against both production companies by saying that they might be cut off and excommunicated from the land of the living in China, because suddenly China realized that these films were like a real offensive. Hollywood was sort of entering into the whole arena of foreign policy, and these films were going to have a fairly substantial effect on how the outside world saw Tibet and saw China. So the film companies didn't want a whole lot of politics heaped into the PR tours and the junkets that actors and actresses were being asked to undertake by the company. So they were trying to stay away from politics. Huh. But it was, yes, Brad Pitt, when I finally met him, was an ordinary mortal, not a God King.
Orville Schell is the author of Virtual Tibet. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division. Publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we meet Vetan Saroy, publisher of Kosovo's leading independent Albanian newspaper. He just won an award from the National Endowment for Democracy. And we continue our conversation with Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. It's about the place of Tibet in the West's collective imagination. Schell is the author of several books about China, has written for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, while you were writing your book, Virtual Tibet, there was a new development that was revealed about the author of 7 Years in Tibet, Heinrich Harrer. And there was an Austrian journalist who revealed that Harrer had been a Nazi. He'd been a member of the Stormtroopers. What impact did that have on you as a great fan of his book, 7 Years in Tibet?
Well, when I actually went to Austria to meet Harrer before these revelations of his Nazi affiliations came out, and, you know, I found him, I mean, it almost seemed to me that he had been interviewed so many times that he was not only an automatic pilot, but he was sort of quoting his own book rather than his own experience. It was a weird experience, and I felt as if I didn't really kind of get to the heart of the matter. Subsequently, when it was revealed that he had this Nazi past, one began to understand a little why he wasn't more reflective and introspective about the whole experience. He wrote a very wonderful adventure book, but he didn't really delve into his own sort of inner workings or his inner fascination with Tibet or why he had left Austria or didn't go back. And, you know, it was a bit of a, it sort of besmirched the whole dream of him as the arch explorer, you know, sort of an esteemable quality, because behind in his past lurked this kind of dreadful Nazi past that had been not acknowledged.
You've met with the Dalai Lama. Many people who have met with him talk about the impact it's had on them being in the presence of this enlightened spiritual leader. Did you feel a special presence that he had?
I think, you know, the Dalai Lama is really a wonderful person in many ways. I do have great veneration for him. And I think the reason why one feels all the more this power is that he constantly eschews the role of God King. He's constantly sort of almost self-denigrating himself and trying to reduce himself to normal kind of mortal status. It's a very ingratiating quality, and people have often remarked upon the fact that the thing that makes him such a compelling person is that he seems to want nothing but your happiness, and one can't say that so readily about many other people. And, you know, the irony is that if one had to have an adversary, such as China does, I mean, one could only dream of having an adversary like the Dalai Lama, who is so reasonable and so sort of gracious, and I think always willing to try to see what it is that the other side is concerned about and to how to reconcile. He's a great reconciler. And the tragedy is that China can't join somehow with this very compelling, very reasonable, and practical man. And that makes the tragedy of Tibet all the greater, because here is a good leader with no country, whereas most countries have, you know, a country but no leader. There's an opportunity here, and the fact that China cannot take it is a kind of amazing, it's a source of huge frustration, I think, for the world at large, for the Tibetans, and it's a great shame, because when he passes, and he's now 64, the moment may pass when this extremely contentious and sensitive issue could be joined in a way that might have a happy ending.
You know, your book is about what the West has imagined Tibet to be and all the things that the West has projected onto Tibet, such as it's a Shangri-La, it's a utopia. China, which has, you know, occupied Tibet since the 50s, has destroyed so much of what was special and wonderful about Tibet. But at the same time, I think by destroying it, it has made it even more important to have these fantasies about Tibet, because the real Tibet doesn't exist anymore. And in that sense, there can't be an expedition that goes to Tibet and is disappointed, because we all know it's been destroyed by China. So the Tibet that we revive in memory, there's no reality to contradict it anymore. There's only history and memory.
Well, that's why Hollywood is so important in all of this. You see, because in fact, the Tibet that we cared about, that we were fascinated with when Heinrich Harrer went there, was a Tibet that stopped in the 1950s when China began to occupy it. And yet, it's a kind of a testament to the powerful yearning that we have to believe in this old place, that we go on believing in it, even though it isn't there anymore. And we believe in it so deeply that, having been denied it, we have to seek refuge in Hollywood movies, which will recreate it in Argentina, or, as in Martin Scorsese's case, in Morocco. And I think it does bespeak of, you know, a need for us as human beings to believe that there is some place that has some real basis in the world that is somehow, it makes sense, some place where we can project our hopes and yearnings for a society that works, that's humane, that's spiritual, that's not subject to all the ambiguities of life as we know it. And this is a dream that we very reluctantly will let go of. And that's why I think these Hollywood movies were so important.
Where do you see your role in all of this? Do you see yourself as the realist, the person who's trying to perceive what Tibet really was?
Well, you know, you might well ask, why did I bother to write this? You know, many people will feel a little bit unhappy that I look at the mythology, and in a certain sense, I suppose, could say I do puncture it a bit. I guess I wrote it because it is such a powerful myth. And I think in some way that's very hard to describe, that when myths enter real negotiations and real foreign policy conflicts, it makes it very difficult to solve these conflicts. For instance, I mean, the Chinese just get apoplectic when they are confronted with this sort of dewy-eyed, you know, view of Tibet, which they view as a kind of a hellhole, which they've gone in and cleaned up. And they get very angry, and they feel very beset upon, and it makes it very difficult for them to be in any posture where they could make concessions or where they could, imagine solving this problem in any way that would make sense to us. So in a certain way, I guess one could say that I can't think of many places that are more fraught with this sort of imagined fantasy life, and yet where the stakes are higher in terms of a real international problem with real people and real suffering and a terrible history of brutalization. And where will it all end? I don't know, but I suspect that it can't easily be solved unless we do get down to a kind of a reality about it.
Has Tibet had any impact on your spiritual life, if that's not too personal a question to ask?
Well, you know, being spending 4 or 5 years on this book and being around a lot of Tibetan Buddhists and American Buddhists, I must say that I find Buddhism a very compelling set of beliefs. There have been relatively few wars waged by Buddhists. There have been a few, but relatively few. It is a very persuasive and kind of a gentle sort of a religion that I've sat through many teachings by the Dalai Lama, and I do feel a close kindred spirit in many ways, and I think it has influenced me in many ways. Just how, I'm not quite sure, but it isn't a supernatural religion. It's more a kind of a prescription of how to be and how to treat your fellow beings with compassion and with respect. It's pretty simple in that respect, and one would have to say that the Dalai Lama is a pretty good representation, I think, of what it is he preaches.
Orville Schell. He's the author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. He's also the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, the editor of Kosovo's leading Albanian newspaper. He just received a democracy award. This is Fresh Air. Vitan Saroy publishes the leading Albanian newspaper in Kosovo, called Koha Ditore. Last year, as the Serbs drove Albanians out of Kosovo, Serbs shut down the newspaper's offices. During the NATO bombing, Saroy chose to remain in Kosovo, but he was a target of the Serb police, so he was forced into hiding. Last week, he was in Washington to receive an award from the National Endowment for Democracy, which is funded by the U.S. Congress to help strengthen democratic institutions around the world. We caught up with him by phone from New York yesterday, just before he flew back to Kosovo. Last August, after ethnic Albanians returned to Kosovo, he wrote a piece condemning Albanian revenge attacks against Serbs. I asked him to sum up what he said.
Well, my basic idea was that the Kosovars, having gone through collective persecution, institutionalized persecution, should not allow themselves to be repeating the acts against which they rose in the first place.
What kind of reaction did that piece get?
I think in general, the everyday man, the people on the street, they greeted me on that. Of course, there were people who publicly denounced me as a traitor or as a sold soul or I don't know what other words they used, were threatening my life. But then that's part of the, of a traumatized society's life.
Now, you stayed in Kosovo during the NATO bombing. Why did you stick around? I think you probably could have gotten out.
Well, I had responsibility. I had signed the Rambouillet Accords in Paris. That meant that I would be responsible for the effects of that signature. And I knew, I was quite aware that if the Serbs didn't sign, that there would be a bombing campaign. I thought it was only right for me to be there with the other people, with my staff, and then with the people in general. In that hardest period of time, I had fought very much for the signature of this of the Rambouillet Accords.
And that was meant to create a peace, although it ended up with bombing.
It was, but then then Milosevic didn't want peace or didn't want a peaceful settlement.
So you were hoping to continue publishing the newspaper. What happened at the newspaper during the bombing?
In the first night, the paramilitaries and the secret police raided our newspaper and they killed our guards. Later, a day after, they burnt our printing press, so it was quite a desolate picture.
Is that why you ended up going underground in hiding?
Yes.
Where did you stay? What kind of people were willing to protect you?
Oh, well, people who knew me and whom I necessarily didn't know. But there was a wide sense of solidarity in those days.
Did you have any close calls?
Well, I had several close calls. We were once surrounded by police in the home where we were staying, and we were very fortunate that after some hours they decided that it was desolate, that that it was deserted, and they got caught in looting. Actually, we were very lucky that some of the forces were more interested in looting than in anything else, so whenever they found things they could steal, they were concentrated more on that.
So the corruption of the Serb forces worked in your favor?
It did, yes.
You've said it before that you realized at some point you were endangering the lives of the families that were protecting you because there would be more of a target as long as you were there. When you had that realization, were you sorry that you had stayed?
There was a mixed feeling because I thought that by staying I could be of some help. I soon realized that not only couldn't I help anything or anybody, but that I actually was in the position in which I needed to be helped. And that helpless situation obviously wasn't a good feeling. Neither was a good feeling that I was endangering other people by myself staying there. And so I was caught during the good period of the time thinking about this.
How did you feel about the NATO bombing when you were in hiding? Did you feel like NATO was attacking you or that NATO was attacking your enemy?
Well, I felt that it was insufficiently attacking the enemy. I thought the bombing should have been much harsher. It should have been concentrated on strategic positions of the Serb society.
I'm not sure if you've seen it, but Newsweek broke a story this week saying that the bombing did far less damage to Serb forces in Kosovo than was reported, and that, in fact, the air campaign against the Serb military in Kosovo was largely ineffective. Newsweek says that according to a suppressed Air Force report obtained by Newsweek, the number of targets verifiably destroyed was a tiny fraction of those claimed, 14 tanks, not 120, 18 armored personnel carriers, not 220, 20 artillery pieces, not 450. What do you think of this?
I was aware of that situation during the war, and I thought, actually, that once they started attacking the objects of strategic importance to the society as a whole, then that would change Milosevic. To put things in a more ironical mood, Mr. Milosevic thought that he would be endangered once the average citizen, of middle-class citizen, didn't have electricity to have his espresso or cappuccino on the terrace outside, because they were spending this war watching from terraces and parks.
Milosevic thought that people would give up much quicker?
I think he would have given up much quicker had there been a decisive attack on Belgrade, on and around Belgrade.
When the NATO bombing of Kosovo was over, what was it like for you to get the newspaper running again? The newspaper was shut down by the Serbs during the bombing. You say the guard for the newspaper was killed. What did it take to get the newspaper running?
Well, the newspaper was running during the war, but from refugee camps in Macedonia. Most of the staff was evicted from Pristina, and once out, they decided that they would continue publishing now as refugees. So it was a rather smooth transition to get them back from the refugee position to the office. Of course, we had to go through the very painful experience of starting to get new equipment, although we were supported in those initial stages by organizations, by Western organizations. And then we had to go through building the new printing press. But the most important thing was that we had preserved our staff and that none of our journalists or producing staff was killed.
My guest is Vitan Saroy, publisher of Kosovo's leading Albanian newspaper. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vitan Saroy. He publishes the leading Albanian newspaper in Kosovo, and he just received the Democracy Award from the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a nonprofit bipartisan organization funded by Congress with the goal of assisting organizations abroad working for democratic goals. Was your home damaged during the bombing in Kosovo?
It wasn't. My home was not damaged. I was, I think, lucky because it became the local police headquarters for my neighborhood.
With the Serb police?
Of the Serb police, yeah.
Well, that's pretty ironic.
It is very ironic, and I think they had, when I went into my home, I saw that they had packed most of the valuable things, which they hadn't looted until then, including spoons and forks and what have you, but that they couldn't take those away because they left in a hurry.
Did the place feel different to you? Did it feel creepy knowing it had been used as Serb police headquarters? And let's add here that the Serb police were looking for you the whole time you were underground. You were one of the targets.
Yeah, it was funny when I saw my door, and it had a sign on it saying local police headquarters. and when I entered, I saw the place in turmoil, more or less, because they had been looking for objects of value and documents and things like that. So I saw actually the past 15 years of my and my family's life spread there out on the floor, our pictures and the things we had gone through.
Do you have any idea why the Serb police chose your home as their headquarters?
I don't know. They looked for me the first night, and when they didn't find me, it was a special police unit, they went away and they got a good friend of mine, a lawyer, Bayram Kelmendi, and his two sons, and they took them out of Pristina and executed them on a road. I think it was probably a sign of assertion of their authority that they would be in my apartment rather than in some other apartments.
What is the UN presence like now in Kosovo?
The UN presence is at its peak. It won't get much stronger. It is an unprecedented operation, and there are very fine people who are trying with very few means to try to pretend to be an administration. They are trying to install themselves in institutions, try to create new institutions. But that is, again, trying to create a virtual reality, a reality of Kosovo being administered by a Tower of Babel.
It doesn't sound like you have a lot of confidence.
No, not at all, no. I don't see them having built an administration, and I don't see them they will build one in the future. I think there needs to be a redefinition of the mission in the sense of not trying to build the administration by themselves, but nurturing the process of democratic institution building.
What do you think the chances are of Kosovo actually getting its independence? What do you think it will take to become totally independent of Serbia?
Well, I think it will take as I said, a process of deepening the democratic institution building process, transforming the economy, trying to create better relations with the neighbors, and certainly trying to create a tolerant society. And I think Kosovo should be measured by those yardsticks and not by one or the other news story.
Do you think you're making any progress toward becoming a more tolerant society?
I don't think so, because a tolerant society can be created only through institutions. It is not sufficient to rely on goodwill of the people to try to create tolerance. If you don't have courts and if you don't have rule of law, if you don't have a functioning economy, it's very difficult to see how you can create a tolerant society.
Is there no rule of law now? Are things pretty anarchic?
No, I don't think there is a rule of law. There aren't laws, there aren't courts, functioning courts, there aren't sufficient policemen. It's quite far from being a society ruled by law.
Is it chaotic?
It's rather anarchic, yes.
You did mention in one newspaper article that people are stopping at red lights.
Well, this is the self-restraint of the society. The society still behaves in its majority with the assumption that it has to respect some rules, and these are built-in rules which people have gone through either inside Kosovo or outside when they were refugees. And this shows a positive predisposition of the Kosovar society to actually build a society of rule of law.
Are you still threatened by the Serbs? Do you think that there are still Serbs who are trying to get you?
Well, I would suppose that Milosevic will try to keep tensions high. But then I don't think that's the major concern. I think the major concern is how to stabilize the society, how to institutionalize the society, and not really keep worrying about this man who's well known for evil.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vitan Saroy publishes Kosovo's leading Albanian newspaper. Last week, he received an award from the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Joan Tui Westman. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, the new novel by Tom Robbins. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope by Jonathan Kozol. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, South African journalist Charlene Smith tells us the story of how she was raped and then became an activist, pushing for legal and medical reforms in her country, where rape and HIV statistics are extraordinarily high. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.